C1M Chapter 3 Marriage The Structure of the Christian Science Textbook Our Way of Life Number 1A
Now, today we want to start with the third chapter, Marriage. And somehow it seems to be a paradox that an old bachelor going to talk about marriage. It isn't such a paradox after all, because as we have seen yesterday, what we are interested is not so much in preaching to each other, but much more to gather together and investigate a chapter, a text. And so we come together quite impersonally and with one view, asking ourselves, let's see if we find the principle of the chapter on marriage. And so it doesn't matter if I'm a bachelor or a very old experienced husband who can talk out of a lot of experience and who is so wise in these human relationships. So we go right back to the principle of marriage. Just as we have been investigating the principle of prayer and then the principle of atonement. So we are going to investigate what is the underlying principle in the chapter on marriage. And as we do that, we will find that Mrs. Eddy presents here again some very fundamental facts which constitute harmonious relationships. And I think we do good to see that what the chapter tries to show is the principle of human relationships and not so much the principle of divine relationships as the relationship of ideas. That is then presented later on in the Christianity chapters. But we are in the world, still in the world, finding our way towards the spiritual ultimate. And on this way, we find ourselves still on the human plane, and there must be a principle regulating the way out of this human plane. That's the world, as we have seen in prayer and in atonement, and now as we see it in marriage. It is showing here how on this human plane we can, through perception of the principle of relationship, how we can experience even here and now a happier, higher relationship. So this chapter on marriage is a very practical chapter. And when I said that marriage seems to me to present the principle of human relationship, I spanned the realm of this chapter wider than just a human marriage. And I think as we will go on through the text of this chapter, we will see that this chapter is not solely concerned with marriage, with the marriage of in the ordinary sense of the word, of a husband and wife, but that it is a marriage of a wider sense, namely the wedding of qualities. And that naturally is not restricted to a relationship of husband and wife, but is really true and adaptable to every relationship. So I would like that we leave in thought that narrow sense that we consider here just the relationship of husband and wife, but that we begin to see that this chapter is really presenting the principle of any and all human relationships. The text gives us many keys to this proposition. She speaks not only of husband and wife in this chapter, not only of parents and children, but in a much larger sense, she speaks of partnerships, of companionship, of society, of the whole human race, even about our relationship with God. So let's span the realm of this chapter wide enough so that it is applicable to anyone, no matter if he is married or not married, no matter if he is a child or a man or a woman, if he is married or unmarried, if he is a widower or not, if he is a bachelor. All that isn't so important. The central problem which we will have to face is this: what are the true factors which constitute a harmonious and an always more harmonious relationship? Therefore, we will find that it isn't so much so much interested in people, but in qualities. What Mrs. Eddy presents here is qualities, and shows how the relationship of qualities are able to give a higher tone to any human relationship. It's a blending of qualities. And as we will go on, and perhaps I will make a point out of it only next time, and a very nice point, a very important point, and that is to see that she shows here that if, that when qualities are pure, and when qualities in their purity mingle or blend, that each quality, so to say, fluctuates. Can you say fluctuate the other qualities? And bring about new, higher qualities. It isn't just adding qualities to each other when we bring qualities together. It's more than that. It's through creation that is being shown here. That a pure quality, blending with another pure quality in purity and loveliness and tenderness, bring forth a third and higher and greater and more wonderful quality. And so we feel that marriage here begins to show a true sense of creation. Naturally, the metaphysical sense of creation we get much later in the textbook, in the chapter on creation, and further on. Another point which we must keep in mind as we go through the text: marriage shows what, as I say, said, what qualities are necessary to bring about a happy human relationship? But also, and that we sometimes forget, how a happy human relationship must evolve further into a divine, lasting relationship. It means that sometimes we are quite satisfied with the first point, that all what we long to achieve is to establish a happy human relationship. But we know that the human is temporal and not lasting. And so the proposition is constantly put before us that we are aware that the human relationship is a temporal stage, and that if inwardly we don't use this human happy relationship in order to go further and have as its aim and view a divine relationship, that every human relation, happy human relationship, will decay and wither away. And so, though this chapter is mainly, especially the first five subjects, are concerned with those factors which constitute a happy human relationship, we must keep in mind that they are only the preparatory stages which must lead on further and further to a divine relationship. Also, it is quite interesting to notice that this chapter does not answer two questions which most people would like to be answered in this chapter. Namely, it does not answer the question, shall I marry or shall I not marry? Shall we marry or shall we not marry? Mrs. Edick doesn't give any answer in it. Nor does she give an answer to the second main question which comes up time and time, namely, if one is married, shall one have children or no children? She doesn't touch that question either. So she's quite wise here by not touching any human proposition and giving an answer to a human question. Her whole tendency is to present those fundamental facts which, for being married or not being married, are the fundamental elements and factors or qualities necessary for a happy relationship, but also for a happy, harmonious evolution of society, of mankind, and of the whole world. Now, this chapter of marriage comes after the chapter of Atonement and Eucharist, and it is very important always to realize that this chapter can only be understood on the basis of the two preceding chapters. Perhaps we will consider that next time in more detail, just to see the flow again of these chapters. But let's see quickly how the second chapter links on to the third. In the second chapter, Atonement was presenting us with the proposition that we atone ourselves with the one God, that we come into, that we stay in that wonderful ideal unity with the one God. And we were quite impressed by the high sense of unity that she presented, especially in the tone of love as truth and love as love. In other words, the chapter Tome and Eucharist ended with that ideal unity of God and man. Now, this high goal is there presented. We didn't see that we must already demonstrate that unity to the nth degree and to the 100%, but that it was first a presentation, it was the word. Because if that second chapter would already ask us to first fulfill 100% that unity, there would be no more need for any other chapter, because we would be ascended. See, we would be ascended. But the second chapter is the Word as the Christ, and therefore was a presentation of the way we have to go, of the demands which we will meet on the way where we are going, and presents the high goal where this way is leading to. And that this high goal can be achieved, and that Jesus did achieve and exemplified it, but asked us to go the way too, to drink the cup and to go the way. Inwardly, the reader at that moment says to himself, this is a very high goal. I think it is much too high for me yet. I'm still bound too much to the human, to human obligations, to human sense. I'm still bound to the world, and I just can't jump from one month to the other into the fulfillment of Atonement and Eucharist. And so the natural resolution that comes in is to start where one is and to make practical that what one has learned in prayer and in Atonement and Eucharist right there where one is at the moment. And so this is where marriage finds us. Marriage comes and says to us, start where you are, in that situation where you are. Whatever that situation is, make that concession that you come down to where you inwardly really are, to your obligations, which you have to fulfill now in this world, and begin to make the best out of it with that equipment which we have got in prayer and Atonement and Eucharist. Jesus, the introductory paragraph, I will take it later on, but just to see how it is, he begins and says, he speaks of Jesus here as our great teacher. He was really presenting Atonement and Eucharist as a mighty, big, great teacher. When our great teacher came to him for baptism, John was astounded. Reading his thoughts, Jesus added, suffer it to be so now. For thus it becomes us to fulfill all righteousness. Jesus' concessions, in certain cases, to material methods, therefore the advancement of spiritual good. See, she takes that great teacher which she has presented in Atonement and Eucharist and takes him now and says, how did he start? How did that great teacher start? And now begins with the rencontre with John the Baptist, where he was willing to make the concession of baptism and said, suffer it to be so now. We begin to see how Jesus went the way, the ordered way. For thus it becometh us to fulfill all righteousness. Jesus saw that he had to go the word, through the word, that he had to go, as Matthew shows, through the days of creation and fulfill the days of creation. That in spite that he was endowed with the divine spirit without measure, he was willing to begin in the world with the people, where the people were, step by step, to work out the human proposition. So we come to the third chapter, as the word, as Christianity, which Mr. Dawley captioned as line. And what we will see here is really how we have to line up everything in our human life as much as possible to our highest understanding, to line it up to that ideal which was presented in Atonement and Eucharist. The ideal has been presented. We know now the way. There is now no more a question that we don't know the way. Atonement Eucharist has shown us that way. Prayer has given us the power to go that way. So we are equipped. And it is now a question, are we proving and using these two first chapters to the best of our abilities under difficulties, time and time and time again, and to use it and prove it in our everyday life? We come now to that concession which Jesus also made, where we must make to the human plane of existence those concessions which are necessary for one purpose, for the advancement of spiritual good. They are not concessions to devaluate the spiritual good, but for the advancement of spiritual good. We see that the absolutists really would like to stop with Atonement and Eucharist. And for the absolutists, there is no need for the chapter on marriage, of taking this high ideal down to the everyday plane of life, to our everyday obligations, duties, activities, because the absolutist says there is only God and his ideas, and there is no human plane beside it and no material plane beside it. Actually, we know that fundamentally he is right, that absolute statement is right. But we also must see that we have to prove that this is so. And we can only prove that the spiritual is so by subjugating the human and material plane to such an extent that we can use divine qualities in spite of the human and the material plane of existence. And this training, this exercising to use that high ideal in spite of the animal in the world the animal in within us. That is the question, that is the problem of marriage. We will always find where we come now to a real training ground, to a real training in human life, where we can see that every moment gives us the opportunity to confess and stand to what we have learned in prayer and sermon and Eucharist, in spite of the downward tendencies within us and the world. That's marriage. This proof and using of the ascendancy of good over evil, that is that which lifts us higher and higher and makes our human plane of existence better, happier, jollier, and so on. Also, let's see that the chapter on marriage, without the chapter on Atonement and Eucharist, would involve a purely moral effort. If we wouldn't have Atonement and Eucharist backing up our whole inward attitude, then trying to have ascendancy of good, of the good over evil, would involve a moral effort. We would have to find the effort to rise above the animal somewhere in a religious or moral ethics. But as we are equipped now with prayer and Atonement and Eucharist, we draw our whole force and power to have that ascendancy of good over evil from that divine source of prayer and Atonement and Eucharist. So, as we go on in the chapter on marriage, we must be aware that all the inward strength that is demanded to fulfill the principle of marriage, that all that inward strength is drawn from the divine, from that unity, that wonderful unity with the divine of Atonement and Eucharist. And then we realize that we have a spiritual, divine background and authority and power behind us. But also, we must see that the chapter on marriage is not the last chapter, but that it leads to that wonderful chapter. I'm just longing until I can start with the fourth chapter. That wonderful chapter on Christian Science versus Spiritualism, where, for the first time, Mrs. Eddy shows that the spiritual is the only. And so, let's see that marriage is that transitional stage which draws its power from the divine for one aim, for the divine. And that in the meantime, in that exercising and in that thrilling to have the ascendancy of the divine over the human, that transitionary period is filled up with what spiritually here is presented as a chapter on marriage. So that the chapter on marriage must always have a high goal, namely to reach towards the lasting facts of harmony, not towards the human sense of harmony and happiness in human relationships, but that it is always used and used for higher resurrection, for higher ascension in thought, until we cast really all our inward longings beyond the veil of matter, into that chapter on spiritualism where spirit is found to be the only and matter as nothing. So marriage is a temporal stage. The whole chapter which is presented here is the transitional stage. And we must be so happy and grateful, I think, that for this transitional stage, which is never very comfortable, that we have a science regulating these changes. The science, here marriage presents the science which controls and governs these changes, where it controls the way out of human relationship, first out of false material animal relationships into better human and happier relationships, but further and further to where we find that one unity and onlyness of the spiritual realm. If we take the chapter and ask ourselves, what does she say on the term marriage? We find that she used the term marriage very seldom. Quite funny enough, very seldom compared that the whole chapter is on marriage. And I ask you in the questionnaire to analyze for yourself what she does say on the term marriage, on the term itself, marriage. I always like to go out from the actual text and ask the actual text, what does she say actually? Because we are apt to interpret into the text so many things which are not there. And it's illuminating because the first thing she points out is that marriage is temporal. We must see that, you see, that it is the transitional stage. It's temporal. She has a marginal side note called marriage temporal. She also indicates it by saying until, you see, until is a temporal thing, until the spiritual creation is discerned intact. Marriage will continue subject to such moral regulations as will secure increasing virtue. It says marriage, the chapter on marriage is that which is, which comes into view until the spiritual creation is discerned intact. Then the chapter of marriage has fulfilled its job. She says, until it is learned that God is the Father of all, marriage will continue. So we see in various references how marriage is presented as temporal. And then we can ask ourselves, for what? What is the purpose of marriage? And I'm quite astounded at the very few references where she shows for what marriage should be. And she says it should be for the propagation, it should be the provision for generation among humankind. Marriage is the legal and moral provision for generation among humankind. So she's quite definite about the purpose of marriage. Or, she says marriage, the purpose of marriage is to improve the human species in propagating it. Marriage should improve the human species, she says on page 60. And then, after having shown rather the physical or mundane aspect of marriage, she takes marriage and says, what is really the spiritual significance of marriage? And she says, marriage should signify what? The union of hearts. Now she takes the symbol marriage and de-symbolizes it and brings it back to the union of hearts. Says the scientific morale of marriage is spiritual unity. See, the spiritual signification to which the chapter on marriage points is really spiritual unity. But of that spiritual unity, she speaks in the Apocalypse. And you will notice that from the third chapter on until the chapter on Apocalypse, the term marriage doesn't appear anymore. It's finished. But the term marriage in the Apocalypse is something very different than the chapter on marriage. In the Apocalypse, it is the marriage of a Lamb's wife, love wedded to its own spiritual idea. Then comes the marriage feast. That's complete spiritual unity of principle and idea, of love and love's idea. That's the highest, purest sense of marriage. So we see that the chapter on marriage finds its true realization, its climax really, in Apocalypse. And so all that what human relationship consists of as presented through the principle of marriage is something which will stay with us and stay with us and stay with us, and which needs consideration, which needs using it and demonstrating it to a higher and higher and higher sense, until lastly the symbol of marriage falls for the highest sense of marriage, of love wedded to her own idea. Now, that's what she says about the term marriage. Now let's take the scriptural note. And the scriptural note reads, what therefore God has joined together, let no man put asunder. And further, in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are as the angels of God in heaven. Now, if we analyze this scriptural note, and we know that the scriptural note usually gives us the main attitude of the whole chapter, the attitude which we should take of the whole chapter, if we analyze it, we see that she takes the touch of principle which unites all qualities divine qualities within principle, which presents the indestructible unity of God and idea. What therefore God has joined together, what is in one unity in principle, that no man puts asunder. It's a statement of principle, showing that that which is united in God, that should never be put apart. And then we have a touch of life in the resurrection, when thought resurrects and is exalted. In the resurrection they neither marry nor are given into marriage, but are as the angels of God in heaven. We begin to see a higher sense of man. Then we are like the angels of God in heaven. And she indicates here that as thought rises on the basis of unity with God, if we keep our unity with God, and as we keep our unity with God, we lift ourselves out of a unity with material and animal qualities, we resurrect ourselves, and what is the outcome is that a new sense, a higher sense of manhood or humanhood is being born. It isn't that she says that in the resurrection we shall be the Son of God. The text doesn't go as far as that in the Bible, nor in the chapter on marriage. In the chapter on marriage, she doesn't lead thought to that point where we begin to realize what is the Son of God and that we are the Son of God. She only leads thought upward and upward of man, the thought of manhood upward and upward to a higher and higher and always a higher sense of humanhood, to perfect humanhood. In the sixth and seventh subject, she presents that as the climax of the third chapter. But she doesn't show it as the Son of Man. So, again, we begin to see the purpose of this chapter. The scope of this chapter, namely to tell us how through keeping unity with God and that which God has joined together, through keeping unity with those qualities which are divine as principle, through keeping that unity principle, how through such a unity we are resurrected, how through such a unity with divine qualities, our life gets a higher tone, a more nobler tone. That's the resurrection that begins to take place. That we ascend and get some ascendancy over. That's our resurrection. And then she always shows that this brings out a higher sense of manhood, an improved sense of manhood. When I say manhood, let me rather say an improved sense of humanhood, a higher, nobler sense of humanhood, which is symbolized as the angels of God in heaven.